we get things rolling like we do every Tuesday, as we're joined by our friend, writer and critic and all-round man about town, the talented Colin Fleming. Good afternoon, sir.
What's up, RK?
Well, I'm excited to talk about movies that, like me, are celebrating a big birthday this year.
They're right up your street, these two films, aren't they?
They are. Movies from the great year of my birth. No, not 1978. Thank you, though. But 1958, two classics from two great directors. And I think in both cases, two films that were so far ahead of their time.
What age would you say you were when you first saw both of them?
I saw Vertigo when I was way too young to see Vertigo. I was maybe 11 or 12. I didn't understand a whole lot about it at the time. Touch of Evil, I don't think I saw probably until I was in my early 30s when it became available on disc.
Because you wouldn't have been able to see Vertigo much older than that, because it disappeared from circulation in 1973. It was one of a handful of Hitchcock films that just sort of left the rotation. And so that added, I think, an element of mystique to what it eventually became, as celebrated as one of the finest films of all time. And both films are sufficiently ahead of their time that there's like a Sun Ra album from 1956 called Jazz and Silhouette. And when you listen to it, if you play it for someone who's not familiar with it, they would be very challenged to come up with like an era when it's from. Like, oh, is that from, you know, the 80s? Is that from like the swing era? These two films are like that. Although I wonder now, if they were made, they are so shocking in what they do to you as a viewer, if they would be permitted to sort of have their run. I've noticed that a lot of the entertainment we have now, and I saw that film, A Quiet Place, a couple weekends ago, it's so passive. You can sort of put whatever you want on top of it. It can have whatever meaning you wish it to have. Everything's open-ended. Ideas are democratic, like we have a say in them on equal footing with the auteur, whereas these two films, no. They are draconian. They are doing it to you. They are cudgeling you, really, in a sense, for entertainment and edification.
Well, yeah, and let's start with Vertigo and just the very notion of Alfred Hitchcock taking the beloved Jimmy Stewart, America's everyman, and turning him into this sexual obsessive detective Scotty.
It's like a John Waters film almost, right? Or just a kind of like perverse Hammer horror, like Andy Warhol, like one of his kind of early films, because in a way it's about wishing to exhume the dead for carnal relations.
Yes.
Like, really, and it's funny because like the original script, which Hitchcock rejected, had the title Darkling, I Listen, which is from a Keats poem, Ode to a Nightingale. And it just cracked me up that was the title, like, Darkling. Like, everyone's going to think it's Darling, right? But that's kind of like the louche sort of almost sleaze that we're trading in. And Hitchcock renders it at the time. This was the end of the film noir era. And it's a color film, of course. But it has real noir aspects to it. And it's interesting, when you look at it, it's like, you know that word hyper-real, where something is like rendered so real that it almost looks artificial? And that's certainly what's going on with that film. And, you know, we think of Hitchcock as this pioneer, but maybe not like an innovator in terms of what he was doing with the camera. And I think that's misleading. He believed in pure cinema, where like if you see something like Rear Window, before anything is started, before anyone said a word, the camera kind of pans around the room, right? It shows you Jimmy Stewart in that film from just 4 years before, but it shows you his cast. It shows you photos from magazine covers, so you know he's a photographer, and it shows you like a car crash, so you know he was like sort of hurt at a race and everything. And it's almost like Hitchcock, if we think of a film as like a road map, like two bars, he puts dots within the bars for that road, whereas Wells is more oblique. His dots are outside of the two bars, and you have to read into things. But that hyper-real quality in Vertigo is itself disorienting. Think of the dolly zoom he does. So, like, if you're watching this film the next time, the camera pulls back as the focus goes sharper on the face it's focused on. So it's a very vertiginous effect right in that camera technique.
And the colors are, as you point out, almost surreal. They are so bright for any time, but particularly in that time period.
They're garish, almost, but they're not overdone. It's, again, that hyper-real notion where it's if the colors are reaching out to clutch you and pull you into this dream hell portal that this guy is in. He's terrified. And if you, like, just read the plot, you try to explain the plot to somebody, it's the most convoluted, right, kind of hammy plot ever thought up. Like, it shouldn't work. If you were writing a short story that way, people would be like, come on, dude, what are you up to here? This is ridiculous. And yet, the key when you're doing something like that is to not have it be ironic. Be in earnest, like you believe it. You want to create a work of art like that from the inside out. When you start on the inside, you simply just extend yourself, and it's natural, rather than trying to get into something from the outside. That's when it's forced. And that's what Hitchcock wouldn't do. And Wells, he thought that that film, Vertigo, was utterly laughable.
Right.
And he said that to Peter Bogdanovich. He's like, that's terrible. He was making fun of Hitchcock for having done it. And yet, we can kind of see that in a way. Like, Wells, I almost think of as, like, if you were a painter, he's kind of like a Pierre Mondrian, right, where it's, again, those angles, it's the obliques. And someone like Hitchcock, his approach is more of a Caravaggio. And so the two wouldn't really sync up, although they had a lot in common. They both used Janet Leigh. They both used Bernard Herrmann. And they both created works that when you see them in the theater at the end, if you're lucky enough to see them in the theater, look at the looks on people's faces. They are weirded out of their mind. That just happened to them.
Well, and, you know, you've got that, of course, the central relationship between Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak's character, and it tries to remake the woman in the image of his dead love. But then you've got the other relationship that to me is almost as compelling between Jimmy Stewart and the character played by the great, the underappreciated Barbara Bel Geddes.
Sad, yeah. And she is wonderful in that film. It's the kind of ex-fiance, and Stewart doesn't understand his Scotty character, that maybe this isn't the kind of the person you should be leaning on for advice in your love interest going forward. And it's like not deliberate heartlessness, but I see that resonating with our time right now when everyone is so either casual about what they're doing, and if you're not casual about how you talk about it, you're slut shaming or whatever like that. But also, people are so kind of locked in upon themselves, and that's what Stewart is in this film. He can't really see anything because of these blinders he has on, and he is just galloping at full tilt towards what he wants. You know, I have a friend who has an expression that's "live your life like a thrown knife," meaning you only move forward. A knife doesn't go backwards once it's thrown. But Scotty, the Stewart character, is going back and back back into the past, and ultimately that's not what you want to be doing. Hitchcock lets him off the hook. He's saved in the end, but his love interest, who it seems like they could have a future together, is not saved, to put it mildly.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, the other great movie that we want to discuss, Touch of Evil, from Orson Welles, and we'll talk about the characters, the cast. Charlton Heston is a Mexican, but we'll start with the filmmaking imprint of that incredible tracking shot of 3 minutes plus that opens the movie.
You have to see the film in the right version, too, because like everything Welles did, post Citizen Kane in 1941, it got the knife, right? It was the studio that's like, no, you cannot do this. And Welles got the gig because Charlton Heston, such box office pull at the time, he thought Welles was going to be acting in the film and not directing it. And he said, oh, I'd like it even more if he was directing. So Welles kind of backslid into this project. And then it was so lurid, so beyond the pale outre, that I saw it at the Brattle here in Cambridge a couple of years ago. And it's just at the end of every film there, whether it's like the Muppet movies or some Godard film, everyone claps. Come to the end of this film, it's just like an audible, like, oh, Like, people could not even handle what was happening. And that tracking shot at the beginning is pure posing, really. William Zinsser, who wrote this book about how you might write better, it's kind of like an advice book that everyone reads or read. I don't know if they still do. But he said at one point, if you want to write long sentences, be a genius. And if you want to do long tracking shots, like Wells does with the crane at the beginning of Touch of Evil, you better be a genius. He could do a shot, line up a shot, imagine a shot, execute a shot, a sequence, like no one else could in filmic history. And this is such a bravura shot that if I was a director at the time and I was getting these plum gigs that Wells couldn't get because he was considered too arty, too much of a radical, I'd just be like, game over. I should just go back to like shooting cinema verite stuff. It's not going to work out for me.
And the cast is so incredible. You know, Heston, Marlena Dietrich, Zsa Zsa Gabor as a stripper, for goodness sakes. And then Wells himself is Quinlan, who, I don't know, to me is in many ways the anti-Harry Lime.
Yeah, Harry Lime from The Third Man, and sort of Harry Lime-ish in that they're both pretty corrupt. I guess you could argue that Harry Lime from The Third Man, the Carol Reed film that Wells, of course, had his famous part in, I mean, it's a perfect film. It's like A Hard Day's Night is a perfect album. There aren't a lot of perfect works of art. Third Man's a perfect film. And Touch of Evil isn't a perfect film. It's a better film. Paradoxical how that all works out. Harry Lime, of course, is like basically killing people with these penicillins and robbing and diluting stuff. And Quinlan is ostensibly a racist in Touch of Evil. He is someone, though, when he makes this sort of race-based decision about someone's guilt, you find out in this wonderful twist at the end that he is correct. He's actually like a good cop who looks like Quasimodo. He's huge in this film, right? The way he's made up.
Oh, yes.
He's so top-heavy, you almost wonder how he can remain upright and not like faceplant into the ground. He's like a giant Jabba the Hutt type cop slug. And he's corrupt, and he's basically trying to get back to what he had been. And when someone's trying to get back again into the past, they often feel threatened, and when they're threatened, they often lash out at the people around them that they think are trying to take power from them that they used to have.
Well, it's a remarkable movie. And now, have you seen both versions? Have you seen them when they went back and made the director's cut, going with Wells' original notes?
Yes, I've seen everything. And really, the only Wells film you're going to get that was made the way he wanted to make it, or that came out subsequently the way he wanted it, was Citizen Kane. Even something like Chimes at Midnight in the mid-60s, he's shooting people who were not in the film that he's literally pulling in off the street and saying, like, okay, you just put your back to the camera here. You're going to be this famous actor for this. So he never really had that chance. And Charlton Heston, it's kind of a sad story, because Charlton Heston strikes me in this whole saga like one of those people who it's your friend, and you accept them as your friend and vice versa. But we all kind of have those friends at the same time that we know if we end up in the bar fight, they're going to be ducking out the back door when things get a little hairy.
Yeah.
And Heston did that to Wells. And Wells is basically pleading with the powers that be and with Heston to sort of liaise to save his film. And Heston, he wasn't kind of like an intellectual. He was more, I'm about the brawn rather than the brains. And that works well for this film because his character is kind of dumb. I mean, but not like so dumb that he can't have some level of mental acuity, but he's nowhere near as smart as Quinlan, and he's nowhere near as smart as the other people who see Quinlan, like Marlena Dietrich, for what he is. And he basically bailed on Wells. And so that was just a horrible thing to have happen. But Wells got in the things that he wanted to get. You have, what's his name there, from Gunsmoke, Chester B. Good.
That's right, Dennis Weaver.
Yeah, Dennis Weaver. And it's so obvious that Wells said to Weaver, improvise a lot. Like, you're kind of a nutty guy, just do your thing. And I don't know, I can't think of a more terrifying sequence in all of cinema than what happens Janet Leigh when she's alone at that kind of, like, safe house, right?
Yeah.
The most, like, sort of ironic. When you're watching that at a theater, and if even like if you haven't seen a film in a while, maybe it's like sort of gone out of the corner of your memory, you think this can't actually be about to be filmed. This can't, I mean, it's shocking. What would happen now if that was in the film? And again, I mentioned a quiet guy from The Office, a quiet place, and it's just so passive. This is not passive. This makes you want to leave the theater. But that's a form of entertainment, because you don't literally want to leave from the theater, but it's on your mind. You think, should I do a Legger? And it's just fascinating the way it plays out. And what we get with things being left out and when our imagination takes over is really when we get powerful art.
If you haven't seen either film, make sure you watch them. If you have watched them, watch them again. It's worth a reviewing as they celebrate their 60th anniversary, Vertigo and Touch of Evil. Next week, Colin, we talk about your favorite poet, the peasant poet.
Yes, John Clare. And I know everyone's like, oh, poetry is so boring. It's never in that in high school. Poetry doesn't have to be boring, people. It can be thrilling. In fact, John Clare, who was so poor, he had to write on the back of bark, and yet he became, for a time, literary celebrity, contemporary of John Keats, wrote what I am going to call the most intense, gutting, emotionally moving poem in all of the English language. And it's pretty exciting, even if you hate poetry.
And we'll hear it all next week. Thank you, Colin.
All right, thank you.
It's Colin Fleming every Tuesday on Downtown.